You know, when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a fraction of what they really have? The streaming service actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only about 6,000 of those are available in the good old US of A. That means you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows. Unless, of course, you use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location, protecting your devices from unwanted snooping and allowing you to control where streaming services and other websites think you're located. There are over 100 different locations to choose from, which means you have access to thousands of new shows and movies no matter where you live. This doesn't just work with Netflix, it works with Disney Plus, Hulu, Max, a UK streamer called BBC iPlayer, and more. I was on a work trip in the UK during the final season of Game of Thrones, and I tried logging into my HBO account to watch a new episode, but the technology wouldn't let me because of geo-blocking. And I wish I had this app at that moment, because I now realize how incredibly easy it is to work around that problem. Here's a more recent example. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is not streaming on Netflix in the US, but I just fired up the episode where Dennis tries to have a peaceful mental health day, and technology keeps interrupting his plans. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, connect to a UK server, refresh Netflix, and the show just popped up. It's super easy. I've also heard good things about that show called Billions, but I've never been a Showtime subscriber, so I've never seen it. But it's actually available right now on Netflix in South Korea, and with ExpressVPN, it took 5 seconds to switch over and start checking it out. With ExpressVPN, you get high-quality streaming from devices like your phone, laptop, tablet, and TV, and crucially, it protects your privacy and security to keep your information safe from hackers. Stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you all 3 extra months free when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film to get 3 extra months completely free.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for March 5th, 2018. On today's show, we're going to be talking about a bunch of news, including some improvements to MoviePass, because we have become the official MoviePass podcast, obviously. And we will be talking about the final Fast and Furious movie, the Roseanne trailer, Logan's Run remake gets a new director, and we'll be discussing the 90th Annual Academy Awards, including the biggest winners and losers, biggest surprises and snubs, and more. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serrata, and joining me on today's podcast is Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And Writer Y Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
Okay, guys, before we get into the Academy Awards, let's run down the little bit of news that we have before we get into the awards discussion. And let's start off with MoviePass. HT, you wrote this article up on the site about MoviePass is taking some steps to improve their customer experience. We have given them flack in the past about their, you know, their app being unusable, their customer service being unreachable. They have updated their app. Their app is a little bit better, and it seems like they're going to be making some improvements to their customer service. What do we know?
Yes. Yeah, so they not only have been getting flack from us, but from most of their subscription base. And they have apparently been making moves to improve their MoviePass customer experience. And they're doing this by partnering with a customer experience company called Task Us, as well as hiring a new VP of customer experience named Jake Peterson. So this is sort of an attempt to sort of rehaul their negative image that they've had, that they've kind of built up over the past year as their subscription base has been growing exponentially, and they've been sort of unable to keep up with customer demands. And this also is in the wake of their subscription base nearly projected to nearly double by 2019. So CEO Mitch Lowe has projected that MoviePass will hit about 5 million paid subscribers by the end of the year, with MoviePass buying roughly 20% of all movie tickets. So that's a huge amount of subscribers. Recently, they just hit 1.5 million subscribers, and to get over a double of that is amazing. And hopefully they'll be able to catch up with their subscription base and keep their subscription base happy as well, which I think is sort of the reasoning that they're starting to take better steps with their customer experience.
It is a little crazy that they are projecting that they will have 20% of all the movie buying public. I think that probably is in America, I'm assuming.
Yes, domestically.
Domestically, at the end of the year, like that, you know, that's one out of every five people in that movie theater you're watching the movie with. You know, we talked about on Friday, you know, them testing these new ways of not allowing subscribers to buy tickets to certain movies or promoting certain movies. You know, if they get to the point where, you know, it's one out of every five or one out of every four people buying a movie ticket are buying with MoviePass, that could be dangerous or scary, don't you think?
It could be if they continue to treat their customer base the way they have been in recent weeks, which is sort of as a leverage to work with other companies or other sort of revenue streams. But hopefully they'll be able to juggle sort of keeping their customers happy and actually working for their customers versus just using their customers, yeah. Which is a sort of harsh way to say it. But yeah, it's a little scary. It's kind of the beginning of every dystopian story, I feel like, where a company controls like the majority of our the way that we buy movies.
Yeah, and we've been heavily skeptical on MoviePass actually being able to make a profitable business out of this. But, you know, if they can capture that much of the market share, they can force a company like AMC, a theater chain like AMC, into doing deals for lower price tickets and maybe even getting a share of that concession money. So I don't know. I'm all of a sudden turning my opinion around, and I think that actually MoviePass is going to be around for the long term. I thought this was going to be, you know, kind of a flash in the pan deal for a bunch of us film fanatics. But I think... for better or worse, this will be around for some time. But let's move on from that to Fast and the Furious. The original director of Fast and Furious, Rob Cohen, has said he wants to helm the last film in the franchise. Ben, what do we know?
Yeah, so Rob Cohen was the guy who launched the entire Fast and Furious franchise with 2001's The Fast and the Furious. The naming conventions of this franchise are totally insane. But yes, The Fast and the Furious is the first movie in the franchise. That's the one that Rob Cohen directed. He has not been back to direct another movie in the franchise. But in a new interview with Screen Crush, he said, "I always wished Universal would come back to me to direct the last one." This is basically wishful thinking on his part. The last Fast and Furious movie, we don't even really know what that is. We know that Vin Diesel has said that Fast 9 and Fast 10 are going to complete the final trilogy of the saga. That could mean the Toretto family saga, and they could very easily do more spinoffs aside from the one that's already planned with Dwayne Johnson's character and Jason Statham's characters. So, you know, the idea of the Fast and Furious franchise coming to an end seems sort of ludicrous. Well, sorry, sort of.
sort Come on, of, that was a good unintended pun right there.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it seems. Yeah, ludicrous, because those movies just make so much money. So I don't see Universal, you know, wrapping it up anytime soon. Maybe what he means is I would like to do the last one in that saga, so like Fast 10. Personally, I would much rather see somebody like Justin Lin come back into the fold and direct that movie, because he, you know, for better or worse, the Fast and Furious franchise is Justin Lin's, basically. I know Cohen started it, but Lin was the one who saved it from the brink of extinction and turned it into what it is today. Rob Cohen also in this interview said, "I started out to do a different thing, but the thing that I did implanted this world and these characters deeply in that audience." And he said, "Most of the time when you go on the internet and read which was the best Fast and Furious, it's almost always mine." And I just think that's like factually inaccurate. There's no way that people say that the first movie is the best one. I think Fast 5 is by far the most beloved film in this franchise thus far. So I don't know if Rob Cohen's coming back, but Yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens.
You know what? We like to give Rob Cohen a lot of flack. You know, he made movies like the Triple X film with Vin Diesel. He's not a great director, but I mean,
Triple X is a great movie.
Is it?
I enjoy it. I think it's a perfectly fine action movie.
He's taking a stand.
I've not seen it.
So I have like a more affinity for it, actually.
I have not seen it since it was in theaters, but I remember thinking how ridiculously stupid it was when I saw it in theaters. I was going to say, I think he does have a point, aside from, you know, that lie that his movie is the favorite among fans, because I have not heard one single person say that. But he does have a point. He did kind of, you know, a director is responsible for a lot of little things, but a lot of directors I've talked to, a lot of filmmakers I've talked to, said half of their work is in casting the movie and the other half is the production. You know, Rob Cohen is the guy that put these actors in these roles that have become iconic. Maybe they haven't become iconic because of him, but you know, he does deserve some credit for putting that family together.
Oh, absolutely.
Brad, do you want to see Rob Cohen direct another Fast and Furious movie?
Not particularly. He's just, I don't know. I don't think he really has any of the, I don't know, the magic touch that he used to have to make movies that were a little bit more fun and crazy. I think the first Fast and the Furious is good for what it is as far as being a Point Break remake about street racing. But, you know, he just hasn't really shown that he still has much skill behind the camera to match what's on screen now in the Fast and Furious franchise. So I would just as soon let the franchise keep going without him and just don't even worry about it.
I have to go to our Triple X fan here, HT Bowie. What do you think about Rob Cohen coming back to the Fast and Furious franchise?
I'm actually sort of apathetic towards it. I thought also that the first Fast and Furious movie was fine, but I will watch probably a Fast and Furious film regardless of who is directing it, just because they are so over the top and enjoyable. I'm sure Rob Cohen will fold in nicely to sort of the escalating series of action sequences that the Fast and Furious franchise is now.
Yeah, I'm just not sure he would get the campiness and the fun of the franchise that has kind of come in the sequels. But I don't know. We'll have to see. Last night during the Academy Awards, a bunch of trailers debuted. The Mary Poppins trailer, the trailer for the next season of House of Cards, and also a trailer for the Roseanne reboot that coincidentally is an ABC show, which the Academy Awards aired on ABC. I'm assuming we all saw this trailer. I wanted to give you my thoughts quickly. You know, I was actually a big fan of the original Roseanne series. I'm not usually a sitcom fan, but I feel like, you know, it was the first time seeing a family on TV that it felt more real or closer to, you know, families I knew than like a lot of other TV families. And I thought it was funny and I liked the characters. But I don't know, seeing this trailer, I'm trying to think of a way to explain this. You know, I used to be a fan of professional wrestling, okay? And there was a group that was together in professional wrestling called D-Generation X and NWO. And, you know, this group of these big wrestlers. And I think like 2 years ago at WrestleMania, I was watching WrestleMania. I don't watch wrestling anymore, but every once in a while I'll watch WrestleMania. And they had the group come out on the platform to receive they were getting inducted into the Hall of Fame. And seeing these guys that used to be these like this cool hip group in like, you know, kind of wobbling on stage because, you know, of all the injuries from their career, and like they've grown old and they're past their prime, and seeing them together was kind of sad. It was more sad than the fun reunion that I would have liked. And I think watching this trailer for Roseanne, I think made me feel like I felt like with that reunion, it feels like I don't know. I'm not sure. Like, this is something that, like, maybe I think we wanted, but I'm not sure it's going to be good. HT, do you have any thoughts on this?
I only saw a couple episodes of Roseanne back when it was airing, and I get what you're saying, Peter. I think that it feels sort of like it's past its time now, and it's sort of a bygone era that we're watching, and kind of limping on and doesn't really make sense for to come back right now, which I feel like is the case for a lot of the fun 90s and 2000s reboots that are happening. So yeah, I think the Roseanne, like many of the reboots that we've seen, should have had its, you know, time to be appreciated in history and not have to be brought back as a undead zombie of itself.
It's also interesting that this isn't kind of like one of those, you know, Boy Meets World reboots or Fuller House reboots where it's about the kids and, you know, the main characters from the original. It's not like, you know, The Force Awakens of TV reboots. It seems like they're just bringing it back and it's all the characters older. Brad, I know you're probably the biggest fan of sitcoms on this podcast. What did you think of this trailer?
Brad, you're muted.
I hate myself. I think that's a weird designation to give me, but I guess I'll go along with it. I wasn't the biggest fan of Roseanne when it was on. It's not that I disliked it. It just wasn't something that I went out of my way to watch. But it's, I don't know. I'm vaguely interested to see, just because I kind of like the idea of seeing what, you know, the blue collar family that the Connors are, how they're portrayed in contemporary society instead, because I think there's a lot of sitcoms today that don't really deal with a lot of the issues that Roseanne tackled in the 90s, and I think that there's a lot that they can still do today in contemporary society as a family that is still middle class, blue collar, that kind of thing. I just don't know if whether or not the comedy factor will have aged as well. You know, I'm not sure if Roseanne has evolved enough as a comedian to, you know, continue the story of the Connors and not have it feel dated, like it's still a sitcom stuck in the 90s. But I don't know. This I kind of like the idea of the fact that they brought everybody back and it's 20 years later, and they're going to introduce new characters along with it, and, you know, seeing the kids grown up and having kids of their own. It's an interesting concept for sure, but I hesitate to be confident in the fact that they can do anything more than just mine for nostalgia and actually create something that is more than just a rehash of what they did before.
Ben, what is your take on the Roseanne trailer?
I'm going to bring it back to your wrestling analogy, Peter, and I'm just going to tap out of this one because I've never seen any episodes of Roseanne. I don't really know anything about the show. So I think Brad and HT have said everything that I know about the show, you know, covered all of the general aspects of the show that I'm aware of. So,
yeah. And it's also interesting Brad mentioned that, like, Roseanne was not a thing that he went out of his way to see, because I don't think anybody actually went out of their way to see Roseanne, at least from my memory of it. It was kind of like one of those things that you'd always catch on, like, reruns on TV somewhere on cable. But I always enjoyed it when I would run into it, but it wasn't my TGIF every Friday checking it out in my childhood. Anyways, let's move on to another remake, and that is of Logan's Run. This has been in the works in Hollywood for a long time. I think Bryan Singer was going to do it. A bunch of directors were going to do it. Now it has landed a new director and a new writer. Brad, what do we know?
This project has been in the works for over a decade. If you go back to the Slash Film archives, you'll see stories going as far back as 2007 with news on development of this project. You're right, Bryan Singer was one of the directors and potentially slated to direct at one point, as was Joseph Kaczynski, and that was even before he directed Tron Legacy. And at one point, Nicholas Winding Refn was even lined up to direct a remake of Logan's Run. So it's been ongoing for a long time, and just now, apparently, Warner Brothers has closed a deal for Simon Kinberg, the producer of the X-Men franchise, who is currently working on X-Men Dark Phoenix as his first-time directorial debut. They're going to have him direct, and they're bringing in the Hunger Games writer, Peter Craig, for the script. Interestingly enough, Simon Kinberg was brought in to write a treatment of the remake and produce the Logan's Run remake back in 2015. So as of now, it seems like maybe he's not writing the script anymore, or if he has involvement with the script, maybe Peter Craig is just touching up or like rewriting what he did when he was hired on the project back in 2015. That's not entirely clear, but it seems like this is could be the iteration of the project that actually moves forward. It seems like it's the longest, farthest along that they've gotten with the solid or the right people, and you know, we'll see if they can actually pull it off. The one thing that I'm most curious about, and I don't know if this is just Deadline being short-sighted, and I don't know, ignorant of the situation, but they're saying that apparently Warner Brothers wants to replicate the success of Blade Runner 2049, but Blade Runner 2049 wasn't what you would call a success for the studio, because even though it's revered by critics and fans of the original Blade Runner, it was a movie that cost $150 million to make, and it only made 240 something million in the global box office, and it didn't do anywhere near as much business as the studio hoped it would. So I'm not sure why they would want to replicate that success. But you know, if they want to, you know, win over fans and go home with a single Oscar, then I guess that's, you know, there are less admirable things they could be doing.
I just wonder, you know, I loved Logan's Run as a kid. I just wonder if it would, if in today's age, it rebooting it would be something people want to see. Ben, would you want to see a remake of Logan's Run?
I mean, I kind of feel like Michael Bay's The Island already was one, right? Like, that's, I don't know if there were any legal actions brought forth against the people who wrote that movie. I don't remember if that's actually the case or not, but that movie is basically a carbon copy of Logan's Run, and it was like a modernized, you know, very Michael Bay futuristic kind of film. And I don't know if modern audiences would take well to a remake, because the original Logan's Run is very dated now. I watched it for the first time just a couple years ago, and it seems like an old movie. But I think Michael Bay probably did as good a job as you can do bringing it into a modern context. I just don't know if enough time has passed between now and The Island, been 2004 or whenever that came out, for people to be hungry for this kind of story again.
Yeah, and I feel like there's been other movies that have also tapped into this kind of same idea, like In Time, which I never saw, but I think has some kind of somewhat the same concept. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I know Simon Kinberg has been involved with the Star Wars series, he's been involved with some great films. So maybe this will turn out good. Maybe it'll actually end up happening. I'll believe it when I actually see, you know, filming begin. But because, you know, I've been writing about this thing for what Brad said, what, over 10 years, 11 years now. So we'll see. But let's now get into the Academy Awards, guys. You know, we're not here to, like, recap the Academy Awards. People can go to slashfilm.com and find a full list of winners, which Brad did a live blog. Thank you, Brad. But I want to talk about, you know, let's start by talking about the ceremony in general. So not the winners and losers, but, like, the presentation of the show. I'll start things off by saying I think it felt a little longer, even though it probably wasn't as long as past years. It just felt longer. As much as I love that Frozen-esque stage setup that they built, and I like Jimmy Kimmel, but a lot of the stuff kind of fell flat. I felt like, you know, going to the movie theater next door at Mancini's and surprising people with celebrities was, you know, seemed like on paper that would be a great social kind of like stunt, but I don't know, I felt like it fell flat. I think as someone in my Oscar party said last night, I think it's hilarious that Armie Hammer thought he was a celebrity and joined them, I don't know, I'm kind of wondering, you know, I'll get to you, your reactions first before we get into questions. But Brad, what did you think of the ceremony in general?
First of all, whoever was being mean to Armie Hammer, tell them to just, like,
hey,
shut up.
I'm not saying he's not a good actor. I just don't think he's, like, guy that, like, people would be surprised about. Like, oh, my God, Armie Hammer came into my movie theater.
I would love it if Armie Hammer came into my movie theater. Are you kidding me? That would be amazing. Armie Hammer's awesome. Especially if he starts dancing, like, he doesn't call me by your name. We can just have a dance party right then and there.
Wearing his tracksuits.
And by the way, also, before you start, you know, there were some great montages, but there was just way too many video montages. Like, it was like, I just want to get through with the ceremony at some point.
Honestly, I would prefer if they would do more montages. I think the montages are consistently the best part of the Oscars. The one that they did earlier in the show, that was the tribute to 90 years of movies and thanking audiences for going to it, that was an incredible montage.
Yeah,
using
I love that.
The Forrest Gump and the Love Actually score and movie clips from all across, you know, the decades of the Oscars have been around. That was awesome. And even the montages they used before the acting categories were great. Some of them even kind of had like a little bit of a fuck you to people that are like against, you know, representation in movies and all the, you know, nonsensical supporters of He Who Must Not Be Named. So, yeah, I mean, I would love to see more of that. The ceremony is always overlong. But, you know, it's just kind of what you expect now, and you kind of just deal with it.
HT, what are your thoughts on the ceremony?
I also thought the ceremony was lackluster, not just because of the length or the montages, although I enjoyed the first montage, but after the next few came along, I was like, okay, just, it's 11:45 p.m. in Eastern time. I'm ready to go to bed. But I think it was because that the ceremony found itself at this really interesting sort of turning point between the social and sexual politics upheaval that's going on through Hollywood and sort of trying to cater more towards the cheery viral moments and like apolitical moments that the ceremony has kind of been known for. And I think that's why for a lot of it felt like it didn't really have a message or like anything that really stood out or was distinctive until the acceptance speeches started rolling in. Like Guillermo del Toro's speech was really great, as was Frances McDormand's speech. It was amazing. But it felt like they were sort of trying to figure out how to bring in these issues of like Time's Up and the Me Too movement without offending anyone. And Jimmy Kimmel actually did a really good job of sort of walking that line. But I think the ceremony itself felt like it didn't really know what it was trying to do. And whenever it had sort of those moments of diversity, sometimes it felt a little bit self-congratulatory, like, oh, look, we had like all this diversity in the movies. Yeah. But the only time I really felt like they were trying to do something or galvanize something was when an actual person of color was talking about like representation. Like, I think during one of the many montages, they all kind of blended together. I think this was the one about diversity itself. Kumail Nanjiani had a lot of really good things to say about, I think he said, it's time for white people to start trying to see themselves in movies about people of color. That's what I've been doing for the past, like for my entire life. So it's time for them to sort of do that in respect. And I think like that was those moments like that really made the ceremony for me. And otherwise, it just kind of felt like, I don't know, a little bit listless, just like, I don't really know what the ceremony's trying to go for. It was beautiful in some parts, but yeah, the montages kind of dragged, and and the stunt itself was kind of a repeat from last year too, which is the, oh, look at all these normal people and how they're normal.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. One of the guys that was at my Oscar party that I went to, by the way, I brought Sally Hawkins' deviled eggs to the Oscar party.
I brought mushroom frittata.
Someone brought peach cobbler from Call Me By Your Name. Anyways, not to get into that, but one of the guys at my party, Jeff, mentioned it's interesting how social political this year's awards, or how the Academy Awards has become, because if you remember, I think like maybe in the mid-2000s. Michael Moore won an award, maybe for Bowling for Columbine, maybe for Fahrenheit 9/11. And he said something about George Bush and, like, got booed by even, like, liberals in the audience. It was like, and it, I remember the outcry of, like, people being like, you know, this is a celebration. This isn't a place for politics and complaining and whatever. And it's just, it is interesting that we have the it has changed with our culture, the ceremony, and it's become part of the norm. Ben, what are your feelings on the ceremony at large?
I loved it. I've got to say, I mean, I am right there with Brad. Like, give me all the montages, make the whole damn thing montages, because I got so much enjoyment and pleasure out of watching those. I think the production design was gorgeous. Like, whoever designed that, the directors of the broadcast, like, I feel like they should win an Emmy for making the Oscars, because the whole thing was like so well put together, and it was, yeah, just so beautiful to look at, all the stage work and the costumes and everything. I mean, like, they really, I feel like they did a really great job making it like a piece of entertainment. In terms of the bringing everybody across the street to the theater, like, all of those bits can go as far as I'm concerned. I would be really happy to never see them try anything like that ever again. And then like, a lot of the jokes just sort of fell flat, like the Star Wars The Last Jedi cast, like, nothing they said, I mean, they were all doing the best they could with the lines that they that the writers gave them, but like, none of those jokes landed. And it was so sad to me to see, you know, Mark Hamill and Kelly Marie Tran and Oscar Isaac, like, these such talented performers, just saddled with really terrible, embarrassing jokes. And to hear like crickets in the room is just like cringeworthy. But other than that, I mean, I think I really loved the ceremony. I had a really great time watching it, probably my favorite Oscars in a long time. And I also really loved how spread out a lot of the actual awards were. It didn't get boring because it wasn't the same three or four people coming up and accepting 10 awards over the course of the night. It was like, I thought they did a pretty good job. Not that the Oscars ceremony itself has anything to do with this, but, you know, just I enjoyed the fact that you could see a bunch of different people from different movies coming up to represent.
Now, the one good joke I did like was, well, I mean, I enjoyed a lot of the jokes, but the one joke that stands out to me was the jet ski thing with Jimmy Kimmel offering a jet ski for the shortest Oscar speech. A jet ski worth, what, $16,000 or something like that. And Helen Mirren was presenting it like a game show. I thought it would have been great if, like, you know, you got to see, like, one of the, like, you know, the guy that did, like, the documentary short film or the live action short film or animated short film go up there and accept the award and be like, it just basically his speech be like, I'm selling the jet ski to fund my next film. Thank you. But like, it never, I feel like there was no payoff because no one actually took the opportunity to waste their acceptance speech.
I mean, the payoff was the laughter we all shared.
Yes, Brad, yes. Anyways, okay, let's talk about who are your favorite winners from last night's Academy Awards? Ben.
I really loved the idea of Jordan Peele winning Best Screenplay for Get Out. I thought that was really terrific because I feel like that was the category that he really, frankly, had the best shot of winning. I would have loved to see him win Best Director, but I also was really, you know, pleased with Del Toro winning that category, and then Shape of Water winning Best Picture was terrific. I mean, I love that movie, and I think it's well deserved. And just seeing Jordan Peele get so excited, and Keegan-Michael Key, I'm sure you guys have seen the photos floating around on Twitter and Instagram of the Key and Peele co-star being so excited at his friend winning that. You know, I mean, it's so heartwarming to see. And Del Toro, who's just like the nicest guy in the world and a true film lover.
Yeah.
Seeing him, you know, finally get to, you know, ascend to this vaulted place in the industry right in front of our eyes was just a really special thing.
I think the Best Director award was is the thing that I liked the most and hated the most, because, you know, it was great to see Guillermo win that award. I feel so happy for him, and I feel like, you know, he's finally gotten his due in Hollywood. But at the same time, I really wish Greta Gerwig could have won for Lady Bird. So it was kind of a defeat and a win at the same time. Brad, what was your favorite win of the night?
You guys definitely named some of my favorites. Jordan Peele and Guillermo del Toro were absolutely deserving of their trophies. The speech that Frances McDormand gave was so lively and timely and important and just so true to who she is. It was great that she got all the, you know, female nominees and even people who weren't nominated, female people who work on behind the scenes and movies and the actors and, or the actresses rather, to stand up and like see each other and, you know, just to see that kind of support and excitement. It was really great and energizing.
Yeah, that was emotional. I know Ben wrote an article for the site. We were going to mention it later, but Ben, do you want to talk about your article a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Frances McDormand wrapped up her speech by saying that she had two words for the audience, and those two words are inclusion writer. And basically, for people who don't know, it's like a line in the contract that people can use to essentially demand diversity and equality behind the scenes on a film production and in front of the camera as well. And this is something that McDormand has said that after like a 35-year career, she's just now learning about this. And I think a lot of people had no idea that this was a thing. And for her to use that platform to spread the word about this in a room full of Hollywood A-listers who can actually, you know, take those words to heart and really do something about it, I feel like is a game changer for Hollywood. It's one of those things that Hollywood loves to talk and they love, you know, hearing themselves talk and, you know, people love, you know, being a part of a moment and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But a lot of these issues in society seem too big to be able to, you know, they almost seem too big to be able to attack in any meaningful way. But I feel like McDormand basically provided all of these A-list people in that room with the ammunition that they need to physically go out and really do something about representation in Hollywood. And I feel like if half the people in that room add those inclusion writers to their contracts moving forward, then that's going to have like a significant measurable difference in the way that movies and television are made in the next few years. So I just think it's a really cool thing that she did. And yeah, just like a very legitimately important thing that could really make a big difference in Hollywood moving forward.
For sure. We are running a little bit long with this podcast, but I do want to go to HT. She wrote an article basically rounding up the biggest snubs and surprises at this year's Oscars. HT, what were the biggest snubs and surprises?
So the biggest snub of the night was Lady Bird, which went home empty-handed despite having five nominations for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and acting nods for Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf. And it's such a phenomenal film, but had had five nominations, which is a sizable amount, but went home without any of them, which is a very sad snub. And but hopefully something that Greta Gerwig won't see in the future, because this is her solo directorial debut and hopefully the beginning of a very illustrious career. Other surprises include Get Out for Best Screenplay. We were talking about Jordan Peele earlier having one of our favorite wins. This was actually kind of a toss-up in the Best Original Screenplay win, because that was kind of up for grabs, mostly for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, or possibly The Big Sick. But Get Out came and took that award, which was a really exciting win for Jordan Peele, and who is now officially an Oscar winner and the first African-American writer to ever win Best Original Screenplay. Snubs Martin McDonagh for Best Original Screenplay, and he kind of got shut out of the Best Director nominations too, and Three Billboards only went home with two acting wins for Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell. Another big surprise is Roger Deakins, which was one of my favorite wins as well, because he is a legendary cinematographer who has been nominated 14 times and finally got his first Oscar win for Blade Runner 2049, and he absolutely deserves it because he did phenomenal work in that movie. So those are some of the snubs and surprises from this year's ceremony. You can read the rest of the snubs and surprises on slashfilm.com.
And we have a lot more coverage on slashfilm.com. We have coverage of the Razzies. We have a coverage of, you know, who was left out of the memoriam segment and, you know, a whole lot more. Everything we have mentioned on today's podcast, you can go to slashfilm.com and read more of or find the links in the show notes. HT, where can people find more of your work online?
You can find me on slashfilm.com and on Twitter at htranbowie.
Brad, where can people find you?
Slashfilm.com. You can probably find me if you search Ask Jeeves if you really wanted to. You can also check out my podcast on iTunes called Go Flix Yourself. And I'm on Twitter at Ethan_Anderton.
Ben, where can people find you?
You can find me at slashfilm.com as well. And you can track me down on Twitter at Ben Pears.
You can find this podcast, Slash Film Daily, published every weekday on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, all the popular podcast apps. Please go rate and review us on iTunes. Spread the word, tell your friends, and we'll see you tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.